So you're going to be a voter this coming year. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, the approach you will take as a voting member, as opposed to just a participant. Your voice matters and so on. But now you've got to vote. So what's
Yeah, you know, I think the Federal Open Markets Committee is being like a committee. Mm-hmm. And so you certainly have come into that meeting with your own perspectives and your own viewpoints. But based on the staff work we do here, you'll come into the meeting with that perspective. But then within the meeting, you get to hear the perspectives of others. It's certainly a committee where my own sense for myself is the bar for dissent is relatively high. You know, there's part of the power of monetary policy comes from, I think, you know, it's more powerful if there's more people agreeing to it, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that makes the bar for dissent relatively high compared to maybe some other situations you might be in when you're on a
mm-hmm.
committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you were last a voter in 2011, you dissented, but, you know, more in what people would call a hawkish direction. You did not think that more accommodation was needed then, and now, of course, you take quite a different point of view. And I think a lot of people don't really understand. I mean, I seriously doubt whether your philosophy has basically changed. I mean, it's probably a symmetrical, you know, approach to things, but can you just elaborate on how and why you have, you know, transitioned from that side of the spectrum to the other side of the spectrum?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, and I think I was asked by another member of the media about, you know, is there a sense where I go back and look at what I did in 2011 and regret it in some ways? And I actually see a lot of consistency between what I was trying to say in 2011 and what I'm saying now. And some of the moves the committee have made in the interim have helped me, I think, in what I was trying to see. So what do I mean by that? So in August of 2011, I dissented, and that dissent was due to the fact that I did not see the changes in the data flow over the preceding 8 or 9 months as warning a further accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically trying to get that mapping mm-hmm. to work between what's going on in the data and what we're trying to do with monetary policy is very important to me. So that's one thing that's changed from the committee's point of view is in January 2012, mm-hmm. we set forth our long-term goals and strategies. I have found that incredibly helpful to have that out there because I now know exactly, I feel like I know exactly what we're trying to do with monetary policy on an ongoing goal basis. There's a 2% inflation target. It's not 1.5. It's not somewhere between 1 and 2. We're happy with it. It's 2. So now I have a much better sense of where we're trying to get to on that. And on the employment front as well, I think we're clearer in that statement than we've been in the past about what we're trying to achieve. So that's been helpful to me. And then I've talked, I think, at a longer length in the annual report essay we did and other places that the data came in differently than I expected. I had been reading the data as having more structural impediments to employment than that should result in upward pressures on inflation, and that's certainly what I was predicting in late 2011 and early 2012, and they didn't come in that way. And at the same time, there was a lot of micro econometric work that said, okay, maybe there's structural stories out there, but it's pretty small. And so between that micro econometric work and the where the macro data came in, that's another source certainly of where I find myself today, certainly seeing ourselves as short on accommodation as opposed to long on accommodation.
Hmm. Okay. Well, you laid down some markers last week, pretty emphatically, in the speech that you gave on the 12th, saying that, you found labor market still very disturbing, Fed should do you know, a goal-oriented strategy aimed at maximum employment. The Fed should do everything it can, or words to that effect, up to and including increased asset purchases, lowering the IOER, and, of course, you know, reiterating your support for lowering the thresholds. So what would be your standards for increasing monetary stimulus? What would you need to see?
For increasing monetary stimulus? I mean, in the speech, I suggest that we given where we are in terms of the outlook for employment and prices relative to our goals, the rate of progress that we're seeing towards our longer-run goals is distressingly slow.
Right.
And this is not just my own individual outlook. This is described in words in the Federal Open Markets Committee statement. Given that, I think it's appropriate for us to be considering as more stimulus at this time. I suggest one way to do that would be to lower the interest on excess reserves, and another way to do that would be to offer stronger forward guidance about what we're going to do when the unemployment rate falls below 6.5%. And I suggested we could keep the communicate our intention to keep the Fed funds rate extraordinarily low, at least until the unemployment rate falls below 5.5%. That's probably it depends on your estimates of how fast we're going to go, but that's 1.5 to 2 years, I would say, of longer for lower kind of interest rates.
Mm-hmm. Year to a year and a half longer.
No, excuse me, 1.5 to 2 years. Because if we're talking about a full percentage point fall in the unemployment rate.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to get back to that, but so you're saying that you think the Fed, the FOMC, ought to increase LSAPs now. Is that what you're saying or not?
I did not make reference to the large scale asset purchase program in particular, and there I think it's a question of. For me, a big question is the question of efficacy. So we arrived at this $85 billion number per month.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a sense in which you have to decide whether or not adding more purchases. If you buy too much, you're not going to have the spillover effects to other markets that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
You're cutting off those arbitrage effects that you're looking for. So for me to go up further on the asset purchase program, I would have to have more understanding of what that would mean in terms of our ability to influence other rates. It's not a question of whether we need more accommodation. The answer is yes to that. The question is whether or not that particular tool would be effective at a higher rate of usage. And that's a different issue.
Okay. Well, maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you were saying that the Fed should consider, not do right away, but should consider more asset purchases.
Certainly, but the consideration is not based on whether or not the outlook is strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
The consideration is whether or not this tool would be effective at increasing a rate of progress on in terms of our goal, getting to our goals of prices and employment. Let me try to be clear about that because it's a very important point. I feel like I have a better understanding of how lowering interest and excess reserves would help us towards getting to our goals more rapidly. I have a good understanding, I feel, of if we were to offer this stronger forward guidance I described, that too would help us make progress more rapidly. I think with the asset purchase program, it's relatively new, it's unconventional, we're using it at scale and that is relatively novel, certainly. I think there you'd have to ask the question. It's not whether or not the outlook needs more accommodation. It clearly does. The question is whether or not expanding the use of this tool would be helpful in terms of making progress.
Okay.
I want to be pretty clear on that.
I appreciate you elaborating on it, but I'm still a little bit unclear on what it would take for you to become convinced that's a
staff issue about we do a lot of internal work on an ongoing basis trying to assess the effectiveness of this program, and I think I'd have to see the right kind of staff work to assure me that going up to some higher number would be effective. There's no point in going from 85 to 100 or whatever the number, I'm picking a number out of thin air. There's no point in doing that unless you're actually going to have the influence on rates that you're aiming to get.
Okay. Thanks for letting me catch catch up.
Oh, sure.
So the IOER, now that's something you say you do, you are convinced that that would work. Why? Because some people, including Janet Yellen last week, said that there's some concern that would impair market function, money market function, and so forth. Others say just wouldn't, you know, be a blip, really wouldn't do all that much. But you seem to be pretty solidly in favor of it. So
I'm pretty solidly in favor of it. I think, Vice Chair Yellen pointed to some costs. I think those costs are manageable. Am I saying that this is the game changer? No, I'm not. But is it consistent with our being willing to do whatever it takes to accelerate our progress towards our goals? The answer is yes to that. And I think sending that in, so the economic effects of lowering the interest and excess reserves from 25 to 10 or whatever number we would choose, yeah, that's small, obviously. Mm-hmm. But with that said, I think the communication value of that would be very large. I think it would show people that the Fed is actually, or the FOMC is actually in it to win it. You know, trying to, is willing to do whatever it takes, as you said maybe too many times in that speech, to get us to our goals more rapidly.
Now, former Vice Chairman Blinder has even suggested going negative on the IOER, as you know. Would you go that far or not?
You know, it's certainly something I'm willing to contemplate myself. There's a limit to how much you can do that because of substitutability of reserves for currency. It's something I'd be willing to consider. I think they're moving down to a positive number is very straightforward in my thinking. Going negative is there is more there's more subtlety associated with that, and I'd have to think about that more.
You know, we have gotten substantial reduction in unemployment. I realize that, you know, what some people call the real unemployment rate, including involuntarily part-time people, discouraged workers who left the workforce and so on, is really much higher than the current 7.3. But just looking at the headline number, it has come down quite a bit. Now, how has it been able to do that in an economy that's growing below what people used to think of as potential? Is potential lower? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a very good question, sort of the big-time question facing us. You know, I think that some of the decline that we've seen, if you look at the employment population ratio, it's remained disturbingly the same over the last 4 years, really, since I took over this job. That's telling us a lot of the decline in the unemployment rate is actually coming from people choosing not to look for work, not from their getting jobs. Now, I think there's a question about how much of that decline in labor force participation represents something that's, I don't like this term, but I'll use the term anyways, the term cyclical, that's amenable to monetary policy. So it really comes down to when firms, when we do increase demand more effectively than we've been able to do so far, if we were able to do that, would that show up in the source of the firms merely competing for the workers that are currently unemployed, that is looking for work? Or would we draw people back into the workforce and the firms end up competing for them as well? That getting that broader pool would keep inflation low. Mm-hmm. I think that the way to try to parse this out is keep your eye on the wage data and the inflation data. Mm-hmm. Those both remain very much very low relative to our desirable levels, I would say. So to come back to the question, I think this question right at this moment is not that important from our point of view. It will become more important as we move forward. And as long as we keep our inflation, safeguards in our guidance, I think we're taking the right kind of risk management, and putting the risk kind of risk management in place to guard against the possibility that we're going to see inflationary pressures at a higher rate of unemployment than we might otherwise see. I think there is a risk. You know, I've talked about going to 5.5%, keeping the rate low at least until 5.5%. Or there's a possibility. I mean, risk may not be the right word for it. There's an upside risk that the natural rate of unemployment could be lower than 5.5%.
Mm-hmm.
And that just depends on how this pool of people who are outside of the workforce mm-hmm. right now, what happens to them as unemployment starts to fall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You also spoke last week about the need for clearer communication about cost and efficacy of policy. And, you know, at the same time, making the case for more monetary stimulus. But, I mean, some of your colleagues would argue that the cost and efficacy argue against asset purchases, not for them, that the efficacy has been relatively low, whether the transmission mechanism is clogged or broken or there are impediments out there or whatever, so the efficacy has not been that great, and that the potential costs, at least down the road, are fairly high in terms of building up risks to financial stability and so forth. So, I mean, how do you see the whole cost and efficacy issue relative to that point of view?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question again, and what I was trying to say in my speech is that the conversation about reducing the flow of purchases has to center on these cost and efficacy issues because the outlook remains so disturbing that the rate of progress that we're seeing in front of us towards our long-term goals remains sufficiently slow that we should not be reducing purchases for that reason. It should be for these other considerations of cost and efficacy. I think this is something we're going to have to reach a collective judgment on. Certainly, you know, as you say, some of my colleagues have expressed concerns on both dimensions. My own thinking right now, but I'm certainly open to being swayed by data and evidence on and thinking that friends against this. My own thinking right now is that we've done a lot of work on the longer run cost side. Mm-hmm. I've certainly expressed concerns in the past on this dimension, but I think these costs are manageable. I think Chairman Bernanke talked about this explicitly in his Jackson Hole speech from 2012.
Mm-hmm.
On the efficacy point of view, I have continued to be surprised on the upside, mm-hmm. I would say, by the effectiveness of quantitative ease, our asset purchase programs. In terms of how effective we were,
let me quiet this thing down so it doesn't distract us. In fact, you've been
surprised
on the upside by the effectiveness
of the asset purchase program. If we look at how effectively we were lowering mortgage rates, in particular in the wake of the September 2012 announcement, that was very, very heartening, I would say, in terms of the effectiveness of the program. I think you see some of the imprint of it as well in what's happening in the auto sector. There's been a significant fiscal drag in the course of 2013. The fact that employment has been as strong as it has in wake of that, in the face of that, I think is a sign of I view that as a sign of the effectiveness of the program.
Mm-hmm.
But all this is really, to come back to my main point, you know, the committee has offered a collective outlook mm-hmm. in its FOMC mm-hmm. speech. It's not hardcore numbers, but it says something what's going to happen to employment and prices. We should have something collectively to say about this employment and cost issue efficacy and cost issue, because that's what's driving this. That's ultimately what should be driving our decision making. We're going to reduce the flow of purchases.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to increase it? These cost and efficacy questions are going to be have to be first order in our mind.
Well, what kind of thing would you like to see the FOMC say?
Oh, I think that it's all purely hypothetical. If we were to reduce purchases, justifying it through a statement along the lines that the evidence that we've seen shows us that the purchases are not as effective as desired, especially in light of costs that are maybe we talk about them as low probability, unlikely costs, but costs nonetheless. That's, I'm not saying that I believe this, but that's the way to talk about a reduction in purchases. Mm-hmm. Right now, we talk about it as the outlook is good enough. So that's the way we talk about it right now, is things are good enough.
Mm.
That is telling people that we're not committed to delivering on a rapid progress towards our achievement of our goals.
What about the impediments that you yourself have mentioned in the past and others have mentioned? You mentioned fiscal drag, and of course the CBO has estimated that to be about 1.5 percentage points. What about some of the other things that are out there? People, I mean, there are anecdotal reports about, you know, regulatory impediments, and now particularly with the implementation of the ACA, that could be, you know, if people... losing their policies, having to pay much higher premiums, blah, 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 that could be a looming impediment to go along with everything else. What say you to all that?
So I try to classify impediments into two classes. There's one kind of impediment that pushes down on both prices and employment, and that makes our job harder. But just because our job is hard doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it. Any factor in the economy is pushing both down on prices and employment. We're charged by Congress to do whatever it takes to offset that. And sometimes people use the term headwind, but that anything that's pushing down both on prices and employment at the same time, we're charged by Congress to do what we can to offset that. And the fiscal drag falls into that category. It's going to push down on both. It's a demand force that'll push down on both prices and employment. The other kind of impediment are impediments that push down on employment but may push upward on prices at the same time. So regulatory changes fall in this category because they're going to make firms less likely to hire, less willing to hire, but they might have to charge higher prices to try to offset this increased cost they're facing. Well, that's a more challenging problem for monetary policy. You have to weigh those two effects off at this point. That all gets mushed together and summarized through your outlook for the path of prices and employment. If the second kind of impediment that's pushing upward on prices and downward employment were really dominant, then our outlook for inflation would look pretty different than it does right now. So I think the real impediments in the economy right now, I think the fiscal drag is one. I think uncertainty is another. But again, uncertainty tends to push down on both prices and employment because it's essentially a demand force. It doesn't mean our job is easy, but that does mean that we're supposed to be providing more accommodation to offset those kinds of factors.
What about Obamacare? What are you hearing about that from around your district? Is that, you know, presumably it's going to some degree to drain disposable income to the extent that people are having to pay these higher premiums, apart from all the uncertainty involved and so forth?
Yeah, I don't have anything deep to say about that. I think the main thing we hear about it is really the uncertainty effect more than anything else. So I don't have much more to say about it. It's one more example of changes in the legislative and regulatory environment, which certainly we hear from businesses all the time are a source of uncertainty in their operations.
Still making noise. Throw it across the room. Let's get to this issue of lowering the unemployment threshold. And, you know, you've been really leading the charge on the 5.5%. But, you know, some of your colleagues have expressed some hesitation. They're saying, you know, it's risky to get down too close to the presumed natural rate of unemployment. It's risky to, by lowering that threshold, sort of committing or quasi-committing to a much longer period of low rates, which then can lead to the possibility of more build-up of excessive risk-taking in financial markets and all that sort of thing. And your response to those concerns would be?
So the first concern about the natural rate, I think of our inflation safeguard as being the way to deal with that possibility. What are you concerned about being close to the natural rate of unemployment? It's not that you, presumably, it's not that you're worried about unemployment being lower than that. Mm-hmm. It's that you're worried about inflation getting too high. And you know, I think having an inflation safeguard, we've put in 2.5% at this point, is a way to deal with that mm-hmm. that contingency. I think this issue of financial stability and the low rates for a long time and how that spills over into our deliberations. I've talked a little bit about this in the past. I think that the way for us to think about that as monetary policymakers on an ongoing basis is, what kinds of risks do we see? The way financial stability is going to impact us as monetary policymakers, we're charged with getting employment maximum and promoting price stability. Presumably, you're worried about the risk of an event that would put downward pressure on prices and employment if you had a major financial crisis or something like that. I think for the way for us to be keeping track of this is weighing that tail event, that risk, against the benefits of trying to get unemployment down and keep prices high through low rates. My own weighing of that at this point is we have to be much closer to full employment, basically at the 5.5%, for those what would have to be, or would almost always show up as tail events, low risk events, for us, for those to really materially affect our deliberations. As the vice chair said in her testimony this week, we have I don't think monetary policy should be the first line of defense against financial stability. We have so little understanding of how that works. People act like, okay, we raise rates and suddenly everything becomes stable. It is very unclear to me that would be true. Dodd-Frank has given a host of supervisory regulatory powers to a range of agencies, including the Federal Reserve. Those are really should be our first line of defense against any signs of financial instability.
Mm-hmm. Are you confident that those macroprudential measures will be sufficient? I mean, there's not a really good record of anticipating these things and heading them off through supervisory efforts, is there?
I think that we're in a much better position than we were 5 or 6 years ago. It's certainly I understand that people would want to have more confidence because a lot of these things have been tried before. But I think being on a little more on the inside, it's not something I have a direct visibility into because this is more done at the Board of Governors than here at our Reserve Bank. I feel a lot of confidence in the development of the resolution planning that's been going on. I think that gives me more confidence in our ability of the FDIC more specifically to resolve one of these large financial institutions. I think that will be in a way that will not affect the larger economy. Mm-hmm. I think that's really what was a critical piece that was missing in 2008. And as well, our stress tests really document, I think, that the system is much more robust and more secure against shocks than it was in 2008. So we made a lot of progress. It's about will. Both monetary policy and supervision are about will. Mm-hmm. So it's about the willing to exercise that will. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other thing I hear from some of your colleagues and Fed watchers and so on is, it wasn't easy getting an agreement on the current set of thresholds, as you know. And Janet Yellen displayed her leadership skills on that communications committee by hammering out that agreement. And so we've got the 6.5 and 2.5 and how realistic is it to think that you can get consensus on a lower unemployment threshold? I mean, just sort of internal politically.
I guess I don't think about it that way. You know, I think about it as what's the policy situation? What tools do we have available to deal with the policy situation? And this seems to be one that would be quite helpful. Then it's on me, I guess, to be as persuasive as possible to my fellow committee members on this point. And I was certainly gratified but not surprised to see the staff work that came out that obviously that staff work was in the English paper. You know, obviously that's work that they're doing, it's independent research that they're presenting, but it was very consistent with the kind of arguments that I've been advancing. So I think that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, everything, the challenge we face right now is that it's an unusual situation, and you're going to have to do unusual things in unusual situations. Getting yourself comfortable with unusual policy tools is, you know, takes time, takes thought and deliberation. It should. I have confidence that we'll get there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, suppose you can't. Suppose you can't get there. You can't reach agreement on a new set of thresholds. What would be your next best alternative? I mean, how can it be? How can the forward guidance be improved verbally, without, you know, if you can't do it numerically, is there a way that you could recommend that it can be improved, you know, rhetorically?
So that's what I was actually trying to. So the speech I called "A Time of Testing," I've given it, I think, four times. The first three times I actually did not refer specifically to the 5.5% threshold. Mm-hmm. It was only the last time I did, and I think that the rhetorical device that I was using in that speech of saying, here's the outlook relative to our goals, and we do not see the situation as acceptable, and we are going to do whatever it takes to deliver on that. Now, the first question you get, of course, is, well, what does that mean exactly? I think it means not reducing purchases because the outlook is good enough. That's step one in leaning into and doing whatever it takes and being in it to win it, is not reducing purchases because, boy, the outlook's just, employment, the labor market outlook looks good enough to reduce purchases. Another, I think, symbolic step along those lines is reducing the interest on excess reserves. I mean, I've heard this issue, these communication issues sometimes get short shrift in the media that you're trying to use mind tricks or something. That is what monetary policy is about, is trying, you're using current choices to tell people, communicate what you're going to do in the future. And right now, when we are communicating about possibly reducing the flow of purchases because the labor market outlook looks good enough to do that, we are sending exactly the wrong signal. So I think that kind of messaging alone, undoing that, walking back from that, I think, and if it's because of cost and efficacy, I think that really shifts the conversation in a very different way. Because, you know, tools aren't too costly or ineffective, you know, that's something different. But talking about it in terms of the outlook, the way we have been doing, I think is hurting us.
Yeah. Well, but suppose the outlook really does improve. Say we get past the next battle of the budget on Capitol Hill here in another month or month and a half, and all of a sudden it looks like there's a running room for the economy, and things really do start looking better. Should that not affect monetary policy?
Yeah, I think it should, but I think that the way you should be affecting monetary policy is more prospectively as opposed to backwards looking. And we should be looking at how long is it taking us to get to our employment goals and our price stability goals under our current policy stance. Are we satisfied with that rate of improvement? So it's not just about, does the unemployment rate get down to 7, you know, and then we declare victory and go home. It's really about, are we making the kind of progress we want to see on, in terms of both unemployment and on price stability prospectively? Mm-hmm. And because monetary policy, it's not, we're not trying to influence the past, we're trying to influence the future. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about how you're influencing your outlook through your choices of policy tools. Mm-hmm. One of the things I liked about thresholds a year ago, and I continue to like about them, they have this great automatic stabilizer effect built in. So you lower your unemployment rate threshold to 5.5%. You do it in December. Then and suddenly the economy improves. You know, it'd be great. Economy improves. You get very rapid growth in 2014. And now people know, okay, we're going to be getting closer to that threshold more rapidly, and that immediately starts to tighten the policy. Mm-hmm. And that's good. I mean, that's that you want that kind of effect in what you're doing.
A couple more, Steve.
Oh, maybe that. Okay. Well, you know, if and when the Fed tapers, and you know, you may not agree with it, you may even dissent based on the kind of things you've been saying. If the committee, if the majority decides whenever that, okay, it's time to do at least a modest reduction in purchases, how should the Fed, I mean, does the Fed need to you know, I keep saying that the LSAPs and funds rate targeting really ought to be separate tools. So what, in that event, does the FOMC need to do to communicate that separation, and what do they need to do in terms of forward guidance to send the signal that, look, this does not say anything about the path of the funds rate?
I think we have to do a much better job explaining why we see them as different. That's what, again, comes back to this cost and efficacy point, that we have to be able to articulate that, okay, we're choosing to reduce the flow of purchases, but we're not in... It's not a point where we would say instead, you could imagine if you thought these tools were the same, roughly speaking, you could say, I'm going to reduce the flow of purchases, or I could instead raise the Fed funds rate 25 basis points. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to articulate clearly and convincingly why those are not the same to us. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that is in cost and efficacy. That's in that statement, in the statement. Mm-hmm. But those words are too vague, and I think we have to sharpen those up. I think that being clear about that, why it is that we're reducing the flow of purchases when the outlook is not good enough to warrant raising the Fed funds rate, that gets to the difference in the tools, and we have to be much clearer about that difference.
What about an inflation floor? I forget where you stand on that. You want an inflation floor as well as lowering the...
I think the floors I've seen mentioned are probably too low to be material. Anything below 2, it strikes me like, why would we be getting removing accommodation if our outlook is 1.5%? So it shouldn't really be material, I don't think.
I'm going to keep on going until Dave over there throws a lasso around me and stops me. Looking toward the December meeting, what do you think the quality of the data will be? Quality of just in terms of, you know, the cleanness or lack of pollution of the data because of the shutdown. Quality of the data and the strength of the data. Is the FOMC likely to have enough in hand, good, clean data to seriously consider tapering?
Yeah, we should be making monetary policy based on our outlook over the next year or two. Mm-hmm. I don't see the data flow is over this recent time frame has been sufficiently compromised to have a huge effect on our degree of certainty about that outlook over the next year or two. So I don't think monetary policy decision making should be influenced by these data considerations.
Okay. One
anymore, Steve?
Well, another, you know, objection that's been raised to this, you know, a prolonged period of zero rates, it's been raised by people like Jim Bullard, among others, that, you know, it really can become a self-fulfilling or self-perpetuating kind of thing where you actually sort of trap yourself or lock yourself into a period of deflationary stagnation, or at least stagnation, let's say excessively disinflationary period of just very weak growth and so on. I'm sure you've probably seen Jim's arguments along those lines. Is there any merit to that?
I think if we're talking about the risks come from, if we only make policy changes, like a threshold change in response to a deterioration in the outlook, then I think you risk people saying, well, creating this self-fulfilling aspect. Mm. I think language like we added in September of 2012 along the lines that we're here to achieve, I'm going to forget the exact words, but basically the policy stands ready to be supportive of the recovery. Essentially indicating we're standing ready to be supportive longer than you might otherwise think. That is, I think, effective. So it really, it's not just a question of what the, again, it's not just a question of what you do with the tool. It's explaining why you're doing with the tool. So analogy, it's always bad to end with a bad analogy, but I'll end with a bad analogy. You know, when I was a professor, I used to make students show their work. It wasn't just enough for them to give me an answer. Why did I want them to always show their work? I don't really care how they were doing on that particular question. I want them to be able to answer questions they get down the road. Mm-hmm. The same is true for us. Mm. It's not enough for us to deliver the answer, what the Fed funds rate is or what the number of the flow purchases is. We have to be explaining why we're making the decisions we're making in a coherent way so that people know how we're going to make decisions down the road. And that's where accommodation comes from.